From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. The American military is setting out to redeploy to places it has never lingered before. Goodbye to familiar Germany and Korea's DMZ. Hello to Kyrgyzstan, Romania, Azerbaijan. The new strategy signals a dramatic shift in policy from Cold War containment to 21st century ubiquity and preemption. So is this the new path to global security or to global overreach? Tonight on Point, Universal Soldier, a new American military heads off the reservation. We begin in Iraq, where another U.S. trooper died today in a rocket grenade attack. Washington is counting on oil revenues to help bring economic and political stability to Iraq. But Iraq's oil industry is in shambles. Neela Banerjee of the New York Times has been covering the looting of Iraqi oil facilities and spoke with us earlier today from Qatar. I asked if Iraq's oil industry is capable of fueling an Iraqi recovery.
I think on a very fundamental level it is, in the sense that it's staffed by really good people, that Iraq owns an enormous wealth of resources, the third largest reserves in the world behind Saudi Arabia and Canada. But the situation right now on the ground is really dire. And the question is whether the Iraqi oil industry can meet a very aggressive timetable that the oil ministry in Baghdad and the Americans have set for resuming exports. And
what problems are they up against, Neela?
The clearest problems, you know, that you could see, especially if you go down to the south around Basra, where some of the major fields are, is damage from looting, and the looting continues to the point that people think, the Iraqis and the Americans too, some of them think that it's sabotage. Things are so badly looted, you think that a place has been bombed, when in fact it's people have just gone through a facility over and over. That's the clearest thing. But this comes on top of the fact that Iraq lived under sanctions for 12 years. So that meant that for years they couldn't get the spare parts and equipment that they needed. And when they did, they were pressured by the government of Saddam Hussein to buy equipment from the Russians and the Chinese mainly. And very often that stuff was shoddy. And so that further degraded the oil industry. So you're having looting on top of an already, you know, decayed and frayed industry.
Neela Banerjee, you raised several things there. First on the looting, one of the first things we heard out of the war was that U.S. troops had secured the oil fields. So how has looting gone on?
Well, I mean, the fields are one thing, but fields need a lot of ancillary equipment and facilities to run. And so really it feels, you know, there's not a whole lot to loot as such, but there are pumping stations that move the oil along. And in the case of the Southern Oil Company, which is one of the production units in Iraq, you have this facility that pumps water into wells to increase the pressure there to get the oil out. And that facility, which is, you know, not anywhere near an oil field, was horribly looted. I mean, even a week ago, 2 weeks ago, when American contractors came to assess the damage, they saw the place crawling with looters, and it continues now.
How can that be? I would think that oil is crucial to Iraq's economy at the very least. Is there not enough security to nail down at least the oil fields and ancillary facilities?
There really isn't, and I think it goes beyond an issue of putting more troops on the ground. And someone put it to me today, I mean, you have to have a sense that it's not just, you know, you can't put a cop on every corner. You can't put a cop at every well, a soldier at every well. What needs to happen is for the Iraqis to feel like there's a government in Iraq, in Basra, in Kirkuk, you know, all over, and to feel that there is a system, that there is law, that there is order. And right now, they don't feel that. And so without that sense of government and order, you know, lawlessness reigns, and it goes beyond Americans sending more troops, because there really is no way of doing that.
You've spoken about suspicion that the looting and destruction of oil facilities may be deliberate. What's the evidence of that?
Well, people look at incidents of severe damage that have no economic gain or cause to them. I mean, the clearest example is that there was a pipeline that runs from the town of Beji, which is north central Iraq, down to Baghdad, an oil pipeline. And someone shot at or blew up the pipeline, an Iraqi drove over it, and a spark from the car created an explosion and fire, and it burned for 3 days. I mean, why would you shoot at a pipeline for, you know, what's the reason to shoot at a pipeline unless you just wanted to commit an act of sabotage? I mean, that's the clearest and sort of, you know, most stark example. But, you know, there's this sort of constant pilfering that people just don't understand why it's occurring. People meaning, you know, the Iraqis who answer for the field.
And if it were sabotage, are people pinning it on Saddam Hussein loyalists or...
About a month ago, General David McKiernan, who is in charge of the land forces in Iraq, gave a press conference where he talked about similar kinds of damage to the electricity grid. And he basically said that they had surmised that it was people maybe loyal to Saddam Hussein, people interested in, you know, further derailing an already shaky American-led effort in Iraq. But has anyone been caught red-handed and questioned? No.
Many of the leaders of the oil industry there are men who were also prominent in Saddam Hussein's Ba'ath Party. Is that an issue? Is that a problem?
Yeah, that is a major issue. I mean, if you do a broad de-Ba'athification or a broad purge like Mr. Bremer has directed, then what happens is you throw out the baby with the bathwater, that you get rid of good technocrats who also happen to be top Ba'ath Party members, and then you get rid of people who are, you know, not qualified either. So it's a much more subtle and nuanced process, and there's a lot of debate within the oil industry of how to do it correctly.
So with all the difficulties, when is it expected that oil may begin to flow in a volume that would actually support reconstruction, maybe even a move toward political stability?
It looks like the best that Iraq could hope for is maybe 500,000 to a million barrels a day maximum exports by the end of the month. And, you know, just from what I've seen, I would say it's closer to 500,000 than a million barrels.
And how long until Iraq can really be an oil power again?
Iraq will become an oil power when the rest of Iraq settles down as well. It's not separate from the fate of the rest of Iraq.
So we're talking years.
I don't know if it's years. I mean, could it be 6 months? Could it be a year? I don't know. I mean, even under sanctions, Iraq was a major producer of oil.
Mm-hmm.
So the potential is there. You know, the question is, you know, what is going to happen with the rest of the country and where Iraqi government go? That's where the oil industry is going to go too.
Neela Banerjee, thanks for joining us.
Oh, thank you.
Neela Banerjee is a correspondent with the New York Times. She spoke with us from Doha, Qatar. The new Pentagon think of the Iraq War was all about lighter and faster. Now the Department of Defense is building on that philosophy to reposition U.S. troops for the next wave of potential 21st century conflicts. That means scaling back Cold War bases on familiar ground like Germany and planting new American outposts in unfamiliar terrain and some of the most remote spots on Earth. Some welcome the age of a lighter, more flexible U.S. military deployment around the globe. Others warn of the potential pitfalls, overextending troops, becoming embroiled in regional conflicts, and partnering with governments with bad histories on human rights. In the 21st century, is the best defense a good global offense? Is traditional self-defense obsolete? Is it all about preemption now? And will the new strategic positioning of U.S. troops around the globe lead to peace or more war? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Washington is Greg Jaffe, Pentagon reporter for The Wall Street Journal. Good evening and welcome, Greg Jaffe.
Thanks.
You've done some terrific reports, and we're delighted to have you on tonight. Also with us from Portsmouth, Rhode Island, is Tom Barnett, professor of warfare analysis at the Naval War College and an advisor to the Office of Force Transformation in the Office of the Secretary of Defense. Good evening and welcome, Tom Barnett.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being with us. Also with us in the studio is tonight's On Point News analyst, Randall Kennedy, professor of law at Harvard University. Hello, Randall.
Hi, good to be here.
Good to have you. Greg Jaffe, take us in here. You've had a couple of reports in the last 3 or 4 weeks that were really pretty mind-blowing. A big one in late May that talked about a fundamental transformation in how the Pentagon is looking at force deployment around the world. Can you describe what's the shift in thinking, Greg Jaffe, and what does it mean in terms of deployment?
Well, I think for decades, since World War II, the Pentagon kind of always thought that the threat to the U.S. came from a country of like size or similar size and similar technological sophistication.
Soviet Union, maybe China.
Right, a near peer competitor is what they call them. And increasingly they've begun to think that the more likely threat comes from what they call this arc of instability. These kind of all these nations that that might harbor terrorists that aren't participating in sort of the global economy. And I think that they're concerned, and Tom has articulated this better than anyone, that one of those nations could turn on them and that the consequences could be particularly bad. Afghanistan was a perfect example of that. It wasn't on anyone's map before the September 11th attacks.
So we're away from the big Cold War opponent. We're looking at potentially lots of hotspots around the world. Talk to us about some geography here, Greg Jaffe. Where does that mean U.S. troops may be flying out of? Where does it mean new outposts may be created?
Well, I think it means new outposts could be created virtually anywhere, particularly in places. Central Asia has become a big place, and I think that they're looking at lots of bases there. They've got bases now in Kyrgyzstan and Uzbekistan that I doubt will go away anytime soon. In Kyrgyzstan in particular, they're looks like they're really hunkering down. They're talking a lot about Africa, as many as kind of 12 different bases in Africa. In the Caucasus, there are places like Azerbaijan, they're looking at a greater presence. In particular, the Caucasus in Africa, they see Nigerian oil as being increasingly important to the U.S. economy.
And you're writing that this is not only about being near potential origin spots of terror, but being about resources, in particular oil.
I think it's oil and energy drives it as well. All these places, the Caucasus in Africa, Nigeria, are increasingly important to the U.S. economy, and their long-term security and stability is important.
Tom Barnett, you're there at the Naval War College. You've been instrumental in helping redefine U.S. policy around this issue. You're quoted by Greg saying, disconnectedness defines danger. That is, countries outside the global economy are dangerous economies. They're also outside the sort of normal, Ural Pass zone. Where do you see this new strategic outlook taking American forces?
Well, I guess first I'd counter the notion that these areas that we're moving towards in terms of future interventions are unfamiliar to us. Because where we came up with this concept that we like to call the non-integrating gap, or basically where globalization is thin or absent in terms of connectivity, was to look at where we've gone with our forces since the end of the Cold War, about 135 cases now. And where we've gone overwhelmingly has been the Caribbean Rim, Africa, the Balkans, Southwest Asia, the Middle East.
I mean, it's a global village. I guess nothing is unfamiliar, but it's not quite the same. We know what it looks like to see U.S. troops stomping around Frankfurt. Stomping around Uzbekistan and Kyrgyzstan is something a bit new to most people.
Yeah, it's new to the public in terms of our operations there, but we've been doing these kinds of responses well over 100 for the last 12 years all throughout this area.
So we're talking about small, light outposts that won't have big tens of thousands of populations of U.S. troops.
Yes, because what we had in the Cold War was basically a static line with the Soviets. And the notion there was, hold the line, time is on our side, the Soviets will rot and fall away eventually. We don't think that's a realistic argument for this part of the world that I call the gap, because that part of the world is already, in effect, rotting, and it's the rot. It's the disconnectedness, it's the lack of economic development and the endemic conflicts that it spawns and the terrorists that spawn from that that really generate the security issues that we deal with.
Which means looking at a lot of relatively new outposts in places where we haven't thought about U.S. troops so much before. Randall Kennedy, obviously the Pentagon wants to take it to where the threat is. What do you see developing here?
Well, it sounds to me like a recipe for perpetual war. This is very worrying indeed for me. I hear that the Pentagon is thinking about pushing outwards the outposts of American empire. And
what's the alternative when the threat is there?
Well, I mean, first of all, is the threat there, or are we helping to nurture threat? In Mr. Jaffe's story, He quotes a Pentagon official as saying, "We're developing a force that makes it almost too easy to intervene. I'm very worried about destructive, self-fulfilling prophecies."
We'll come back and look at that. We're talking tonight about the universal soldier, the redeployment of American forces to the far corners of the earth. You can join the conversation. Is the best defense now a good global offense? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the universal soldier, the redeployment of American forces to the far corners of the earth. You can join the conversation tonight. Must the United States be the world's policeman? Do you want American troops, American bases on the far perimeter, ready to strike fast? And is traditional self-defense now obsolete? Is it all about preemption? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. My guest tonight, Greg Jaffe with The Wall Street Journal. He's had several big articles recently on a fundamental shift in Pentagon strategy that will take U.S. forces and put new U.S. bases, lighter, smaller than we're used to, in Germany, Japan, Korea, all over the place. He names many countries that are possible locations: Algeria, Morocco, Tunisia, Kyrgyzstan, Uzbekistan, Senegal, Ghana, Mali, Kenya. Also with us tonight from Portsmouth, Rhode Island, Tom Barnett, professor of war analysis at the Naval War College and one of the authors of the new strategy we're discussing tonight. And with us as tonight's news analyst, Randall Kennedy of Harvard Law School. You can join the conversation as well at 1-800-423-8255. Greg Jaffe, paint a picture for us, if you would. You've been in Kyrgyzstan recently. What does the U.S. footprint there look like, and what does it portend?
Well, right now it's actually a coalition. Danes, the Italians, the U.S. are all at a base there. It's about 1,500 troops total. It's an air base. And it's basically a big tent city right now. Across the runway from that tent city, the U.S. has leased about 750 acres.
For the price of what it would what they would earn growing wheat on that land per year.
Yeah, they negotiated it based on the old Soviet wheat standard. The Kyrgyz haven't quite let go of Soviet times.
That must be the biggest bargain in the Pentagon budget.
I don't know. but they're laying water and power and sewer lines there, and they're going to build semi-permanent buildings. And I think it's pretty clear to everyone that the Pentagon, or that the military is not leaving that area.
So smaller, but you say this might not even be the full model. There may even be lighter places that will be very austere. I don't know, landing strips and what, where American troops will be posted, or where they'll just come in once or twice a year?
Well, I think at those places there won't be a permanent presence, but the troops might roll in once or twice a year to do training exercises. In some cases, it might just be a dirt airstrip.
And what does it mean to have such small places? And will some of them have little contingents of soldiers? It brings Dances with Wolves to mind. Are we going to have Dances with Yaks out in Central Asia?
I think the Kyrgyzstan base is not going to be like that. I think that there will be a small presence there, at least at all times, and that an air wing or what the Air Force calls an air expeditionary force, which is might come through and train there for a little while and then leave. At these small, austere bases, I think that there probably won't be any permanent presence. You come through, you do some training, you interact with the local military there, and then you leave.
But these are all about fast force projection. Tom Barnett, can you give us some scenarios in which this kind of base may be crucially important to the United States in the coming years?
Well, I think when you look at these parts of the world that are so disconnected from globalization, where you're seeing really the vast majority of the civil wars, basically all the civil wars, all the genocide, all the mass rape by forces as a tool of terror, that's where you're seeing most of the human rights abuses in the system. It's where you're seeing most of the violence and most of the death. The scenarios we're going to go into are not going to be major regional wars. They're not going to be big wars where country A attacks country B. They're going to be conflict that's subnationally or transnationally defined. It's going to be violence perpetrated by individuals against individuals. So the focus on lightness is about getting down to the point where we can get better at dealing with individuals that are seeking to create violence.
But is this really about the United States intervening to stop violence in the Congo or right now in Liberia? I don't see U.S. troops shipping out from Ramstein Air Base to quell violence in Monrovia. Or is it about defusing potential terrorist attacks, or is it really about oil?
Well, it's about all three of those things. I mean, we go to the Middle East because there is oil. We don't go to the Middle East, one could argue, we, the West, because there isn't any oil, because there's nothing there we really value enough to go and stop the violence over, even though there's 3 or 4 million dead there in the last half century, and we're all living through an effective Holocaust that nobody seems to give a damn about, frankly. But it's going to be all those kinds of situations. But let me just back off and say, this notion of world policemen, this notion of universal soldier, this notion of perpetual war, all that kind of fatalistic hyperbole is just way off base. Where we've gone for the last 12 years involves roughly 2 billion out of the global population of 6. It is not everywhere. It is not scattered. It is not remote. It is concentrated in the Caribbean Rim, Sub-Saharan Africa, Southwest Central Asia, Southeast Asia. It is not where the other 4 billion live and progressively integrate through globalization, and where you see rising standards of living, increasing trade, increasing connectivity. So this notion of global policemen is way overblown. Perpetual war is way overblown. If you look at combat operations in the 70s, as a percentage of all the activity we engaged in, 5%. Same in the 80s, same in the 90s, same today.
Let's put perpetual war aside for a moment. I don't see how you say global policeman is overblown. What I read here, Greg Jaffe, tell me if I'm wrong, is about new technologies, faster ships, being able to take U.S. soldiers wherever they're needed in days or hours. That sounds like rapid force projection wherever it's required. Am I wrong on that, Greg?
Well, I don't think you're wrong that they want to be able to get places quickly. I think they'll choose. I mean, I think that their notion is that they'll choose their fights. I don't think that they will be everywhere. And the Congo and Liberia and Mauritania and all those places where we see conflicts right now, where there isn't a large U.S. force, show that. I mean, I think the critical thing is deciding whether this is poses a threat. To a certain extent, I think just the Pentagon believes that just having a presence is meaningful. A good example is you look at the 1,500 troops in Djibouti right now as part of the war on terrorism.
The Horn of Africa, East Africa.
Right, right. They haven't. You don't see them going out on strike missions in the area, but I think the Pentagon feels just their mere presence in the Horn of Africa sends a very strong message to all those countries. Relatively lawless places around there.
So and Tom Barnett says it won't be used, it'll only be used when it needs to, and the record shows that. But you quote retired Vice Admiral Lyle, is it Bien?
Bien,
saying, we are developing a force that makes it almost too easy to intervene. This seems to go to Randall Kennedy's point.
Well, I think he said, I worry. I don't think he said that, but I think that's one of the concerns, and it's one of the...
I'm sorry, I want to be clear. You quote him saying that.
Yeah. No, he said, I think I worry.
He said, I am concerned about America pounding herself out, which I take to mean
right. Deploying
too often, stripping her gears.
Right. Well, and that came out of the context of he was participating in a war game at the Army War College where he was the blue team commander for Asia, and the Army... got itself into a fight in that part of the country that it found itself very in that part of the world in Southeast Asia.
And in its wargaming, as you describe it, it could never get itself out of these conflicts, even though it was nearby and ready to intervene quickly.
Right. It was a subnational threat. The game, it was a large country in Southeast Asia that had an extremist Muslim population that had sort of taken down part of that country and was running it from the main government, which was somewhat corrupt and had made itself vulnerable.
Greg Jaffe, you are doing some terrific reporting in the Wall Street Journal, and I want to thank you for joining to share some of it with us tonight. Thank you so much for being with us. I know we have to let you go.
Sure.
Greg Jaffe is Pentagon reporter for the Wall Street Journal. Randall Kennedy, I want to let you and Tom Barnett have it out a little bit on this issue of whether this new deployment is a foundation for peacekeeping and for stopping violence that needs to be stopped, is Tom Barnett's view, or whether, as you've put forward, it sets us up for a perpetual war.
Listen, I'm worried about these failed countries, these failed nation states, and the havoc that they wreak as well. The question is, what do we do about it? Do we use military might to try to deal with this, or do we use some other sorts of mechanisms like international bodies, like Better use of foreign aid, more generous use of foreign aid, to drain the reservoir of bad will, poverty, all the other things that are leading to these international problems.
Tom Barnett, how about it? Our Randall Kennedy sees a kind of global garrison state instead of development efforts to drain the swamp.
Well, I think it's not so much a matter of anybody making the argument that the military is the answer for everything. We think the military is the answer for those situations in these regions where the insecurity is so great, where the endemic conflict is so persistent, where the violence claims so many lives, that until somebody comes in externally and forces the end of the conflict, you can't see any sort of healing begin. You can't see the non-governmental organizations, the aid groups come in. You can't see the foreign aid flow. And ultimately, you can't see the most important thing, the flow that really integrates countries into the global economy, and that's the flow of foreign direct investment.
But that once again describes U.S. forces as a kind of humanitarian force. Do you really see that, Tom Burnett, as U.S. forces going in and saying, hey, we don't have good civic mindedness here. We're going to be on the streets until this country shapes up. We're in Iraq now, and it's already a pretty overwhelming task. Are we really going to be taking on more undeveloped, disconnected countries, as you describe them, unless they are an imminent threat to the United States?
We have been doing this for quite some time since the end of the Cold War. We are going to do more of it because that's where the threat, the instability, and the violence is found. What we need to be able to develop is to reposition our forces, not only in terms of where they are geographically, but what we bring to the table in terms of capabilities. There has been this theory inside the Pentagon for the last 5 or 6 years that the real danger is our inability to access the battle space because foreign militaries will keep us out of regional conflicts by denying us access.
A la Turkey in the Iraq War.
Right. That's been blown out of the water with Afghanistan and Iraq. What we find is that we don't have any trouble accessing the battle space and dominating the battle space. What we have trouble accessing is the transition space, the outcome space, what comes after.
And it sounds like we're going to have a lot of transition space coming up. A lot of callers want to join us. Let's turn to them. James is calling from Windham, Massachusetts. Hi, James. You're on the air.
Hi. How do you do?
Great. Thanks.
It's a great show. I'm really involved in this thing. I'd like to take a longer and a somewhat more subversive view of this. I think if you look at this Pentagon strategy and just change a few words, it is really about global domination. We have chosen to have essentially violence to be essentially the military response to be our stopgap, our bottom line stopgap in all of these things. And I'd like to say that, in my view, we are very much playing al-Qaeda's game for them. We are marching lockstep in a march that they are playing for us in that the September 11th bombing induced us to act very much like the empire that they always said we were.
James, I've got it, and your cell phone's getting a little weak on us there, so let us pick it up right there with that. And I want to welcome into our conversation Owen Cote. He is Associate Director of the MIT Security Studies Program. Owen Cote, let me put that straight to you. Whether what we're looking at here is a future that brings the United States global security, global domination, You know this new strategy that's coming out. Is this the right balance of force projection and as Randall Kennedy would put it, kind of alternative approaches to global security and peace?
What I want to do is kind of break up the discussion that we've been having into two pieces. The sort of force realignment that Greg's been writing about and that has been announced.
And Tom Barnett's been helping
helped define. Really, the core of that is moving forces, particularly in Europe and Germany in particular and Korea, out of places where it's kind of dysfunctional to have them for lots of different reasons.
And nobody's arguing about that. Why do we need tens of thousands of troops in Germany?
That is an absolute no-brainer. And that's mostly what's going on here. And then there's some discussion about new kinds of operating locations for some of these forces. Some of them will probably just go back to the U.S. Some of them may just leave the force structure. There's a second question, which is what do you do with that? And normally, a decision to realign forces doesn't necessarily also involve a sort of cosmic redefinition of our whole foreign policy and military strategy. But that's what this discussion sounds like. And I think it's
that's what we're reading. That's what we're told. Are you disputing that? And Tom Barnett is saying we got to step up to a new reality.
I was struck by the idea that in this very famous recent interview that Paul Wolfowitz exposed himself to in Vanity Fair, mm-hmm. that's been the subject of all this debate about what the reasons why we went into Iraq for. He was quite explicit in saying that one of the reasons we ended up going there that we didn't talk about much was to improve the lot of the Iraqi people and to stabilize an unstable situation.
Well, that's become a big theme since the biological and chemical weapons have been shown.
He was very clear about the fact that you would never do that as the sole reason. What he was saying was that there were other reasons. WMD was one. You know, ending the need to contain Iraq militarily was another.
But peacekeeping
was not by itself a reason. And this is an administration that ran when it came into office on the idea that you don't go into Bosnia and establish this long presence of U.S. forces there tied up in all
the... A humble foreign policy.
Right. A humble foreign policy. A foreign policy in which we don't get involved in all of the world's ills. Now, you can decide that you've changed your mind and that global terrorism is somehow linked to these... to the existence of violence in failed states that are ubiquitous throughout the world and not part of globalization. But that's a massive transformation in our foreign policy.
So what does it mean to scatter these outposts along the arc that Tom Barnett's describing here for us tonight?
Well, in some cases, for example, in the air base in Kyrgyzstan that Greg's been writing about, the Air Force, I disagree with Tom a little bit. The access issue is still real. The access issue had direct impacts on operations in Iraq. There are other scenarios that people can imagine where there'd be even more serious. For the Air Force right now, in some cases, they're in the mode of they'll take a base wherever they can get one that's more in the region where, as Tom points out, we have historically been operating.
But
for the
list
last 10
that Greg Jaffe's putting down here would indicate that we can get access to an awful lot of places, or at least realistically contemplated. I mean, he's got a list as long as your arm of countries where we might have outposts. Tom Barnett, do you see problems getting where the U.S. needs to be?
Well, there's always been this bugaboo since the end of the Cold War within the Pentagon that we're going to be forced to go into situations where we have no friends.
Mm-hmm.
And the history just has not borne this out. We find countries each and every time that are willing to let us in, and we find that we are able to work around those situations like a Turkey with Iraq, where we couldn't get in, with great effectiveness.
And what about the price of that? Greg Jaffe raises the issue, raised by humanitarians, human rights groups, that what this ends up with is the U.S. kind of back in some Cold War style, potentially back in bed with dictators in Kyrgyzstan. The son of the president has a $20 million contract to fuel U.S. Vehicles there.
Right.
Does this mean that the U.S. is going to have to turn a blind eye to the very kind of misgovernment that I thought I heard you describing us heading out there to try and head off?
It's going to be a difficult row to hoe, absolutely. I mean, if we wanted to have the cleanest relationships and the nicest military-to-military ties, then we would just practice with our European friends and with our other friends that are part of the globalized economy, and we'd never bother going to the bad neighborhoods.
We'd say anything, or just anything goes there, never mind.
Right, right. But, I mean, and frankly, you could almost go down that path if it wasn't for the energy coming out of Central Asia and the Middle East. But that energy matters to us. It matters dramatically.
But we're going to come back and ask you about the Wolfowitz point that we're not going into places just to be good guys. We're going in when real national interests are at stake. We want to hear more on that. We're talking tonight about the universal soldier, and I'm sticking with that phrase. It sounds to me like the American soldier is headed all over the world about the redeployment of American forces to some far corners of the earth. What do you think? Is the globalization of U.S. military power a good thing, a necessary thing? Does the Pentagon risk overreach here? And when U.S. military facilities are everywhere, will the Pentagon be tempted to intervene anywhere? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the universal soldier, the redeployment of American forces to the far corners of the earth. You can join the conversation. Is the best defense now a good global offense? And what about human rights? Will U.S. military projection put the United States in bed with dictators? And is U.S. military projection the key now to world peace, or is it a recipe for perpetual conflict? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. My guests tonight are Tom Barnett, professor of warfare analysis at the Naval War College. in Rhode Island and advisor to the Office of Force Transformation with the Office of the Secretary of Defense. From MIT Security Studies Program, Associate Director Owen Cote with us in the studio tonight. Also, our news analyst tonight, Randall Kennedy of Harvard Law School. You can join us as well. Rudiger is calling from Providence, Rhode Island. Hi, Rudiger. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
My question is for Tom Barnett, and it pertains to something that's been called the Mogadishu effect.
Right.
As we remember, a decade ago, a number of U.S. troops were killed on a peacekeeping mission in the Somalian capital.
Black Hawk down, and it got ugly very fast and a lot of deaths.
Absolutely. The Mogadishu effect, I think, refers to a feeling that Americans are unwilling to have their troops go off and die in places that are not perceived to be of great strategic interest. And that has been cited as the reason why we did nothing in Rwanda in 1994, the U.S. has been reluctant to engage in a lot of these, violent but maybe peripheral conflicts.
Rudiger, let me ask you first, though. Is Mogadishu's pre-2001, 9/11? Does that make a difference?
That's what I want to ask your analyst, because it seems to me if this gap that he's talking about really does exist, then Mogadishu's got to be in it. Does that now mean that we are willing to send troops to places like that to fight and possibly die?
Tom Barnett.
Yeah, it's also called generically the CNN effect. If you get the violence against Americans, you get American casualties, you get it on television, the American public doesn't have a stomach for it and wants out quickly.
Well, that's one way of looking at it, but those Army Rangers who died in Mogadishu felt something more than a CNN effect.
Absolutely. I mean, the most precious thing we got in this military are the people. That's what we pay the most for. That's what we value the most politically.
So if
we lose them, it's an incredibly important thing.
But if we're deploying more widely and putting outposts out there, is implicit in that a presumption that Americans will support more frequent deployment, that 9/11 has changed U.S. attitudes, changed Pentagon attitudes, said we've got to stand up and be ready to go and preempt?
Well, I think the main point about the Mogadishu effect was our vision in terms of where we were going with the Somalia was unclear. And small losses, when we can't figure out what we're doing, seem very large. But the American public has shown itself willing to take serious losses historically when there are when a clear vision is expressed as to what the danger is and what we're trying to achieve, and when it looks like we're achieving what we're setting out to do in an efficient and somewhat rapid fashion. We're good at taking down countries. We're good at taking down dictatorships. We're good at taking down military threats. What we have to get better at is the follow-on game. And Somalia is a good example of kind of the back-to-the-future lessons we need to go back and look at, like a Haiti, like a Somalia, like some of the peacekeeping that we did in the Balkans. We have to go back and revisit a lot of those lessons. We have to look at the skill sets that we need. We have to ask ourselves, are our forces properly balanced? Do we have, for example, enough non-lethal technology to do the kind of police work that inevitably follows these conflicts?
But Owen Cote, I want to put to you, Tom Barnett is kind of leaping ahead here to the follow-on game, but what strikes me first, and the follow-on game is big, we're fixated on in Iraq right now, but first, we have many new outposts coming up here. The idea that we're good at taking down bad countries, bad governments, bad people. Is there a consensus in the Pentagon or in the country, to your mind, for the U.S. to go around taking down countries?
I think what we have to get back to is the concept of vital interests and very imminent dangers to the United States. I mean, there's a lot of things that the military is good at doing. There's a lot of places in the world where the military can go and do what it's good at doing. It's vital interests and threats to the country that Tom correctly points out American people will be willing for us to run risks to protect.
But does deploying in more places where we can go into action more quickly mean that vital interests will be kind of dragged down a bit? The grandeur of it becomes a bit less because you're only 2 hours from X, Y, or Z place. Let's go.
The deployment itself is harmless. I mean, the deployment itself in principle, unless what you do is choose a bunch of countries where you create more problems than you solve by having our forces there. But, I mean, deploying our Army, our Marines and our Navy are forward deployed all over the world, all the time. They have been, throughout the Cold War and have been for the last 10 years.
But not quite in this way. Vice Admiral Lyle Bien says, we're developing a force that makes it almost too easy to intervene. Do you agree?
I do not agree that Senator Russell Long, from Louisiana said in the early 60s to Robert McNamara when he wanted to build the first generation of sea lift ships, which we later now have built. He said, you know, if I give you this capability to always go places, you're always going to be going places. And no, I'm not going to let you have them. I don't think he was right. I think the American military has to be able to deploy quickly. I think the American military can be moved to places that will make it easier to do that.
New high-speed catamarans can travel 2,000 miles in less than 48 hours. That's incredible.
And we should do that. Now, it's the purpose that you are making these deployments to support that is really the issue here. This is really what the debate is. And I get scared when I hear that we are going to be in the face of all the countries that aren't part of globalization. I get very scared about that.
There's quite a few. Randall Kennedy?
Well, I guess I have to disagree with you. It seems to me this might be the first time I've ever agreed with Senator Long. If you have the power at the ready, you will use it. I mean, it seems to me that it doesn't mean it has to occur. It's nothing inevitable about it. But is this a risk? It seems to me, of course it's a risk.
We did not go to war with the Soviet Union.
We've never used nukes.
We came close, and I think that in this discussion, there are various aspects, by the way, of our history since World War II that have not been mentioned here. I think we're caught up in a real triumphalism. We came awfully close with Cuba, awfully close to catastrophe, international catastrophe, and I haven't heard the word Vietnam or the term, the country Vietnam, used here. That was a terrible stubbing of the toe, more than that, 50,000 dead. We ought to remember that.
We ought to remember
in this moment when we, I think, are caught up with too much pride at sacking Saddam.
And feeling good. Let's get one more call. Peter's calling from Medford, Massachusetts. Hi, Peter. You're on the air.
How you doing?
Fine, thanks.
Listen, I just want to give a perspective and maybe a question for as a
make it quick, Peter. Our time is short.
Combat veteran from a Marine Corps combat veteran. Here's my question. I definitely think anybody who has kids in the military, and I don't have kids in the military, should have hesitation of sending American troops as 911 reaction unless it's a vital interest. You know what I'd like to throw out to your audience
Please.
In consideration? Why don't we have some volunteer forces that, for example, to share the burden where children of professors from BU and Harvard and academic types will have their kids volunteer from 18 to 25, pick up a rifle, get infantry training.
Ship out to
under
Uzbekistan.
The United Nations. And the United Nations and share this burden. Become like, through National Guard. And so the next time there's a crisis in Rwanda or some other place, they're willing to step up to the plate and get shipped over rather than sending some American soldier. Right?
Peter, we've got it. Everybody's shoulder to the wheel or get a little more humility. And we take your point. Thanks for your call. Tom Barnett, I'm going to let this come back around to you because you're part of this new strategy. Are you still standing up and saying that what we're headed out here to do is humanitarian work? Isn't this, in Paul Wolfowitz's description, really about vital interests? And are we going to go more often once we've got the gunpowder out there to do it?
Well, I dispute the notion that just because we have it, we have to use it. The military's had a lot of things that they've not used over history. I think Wolfowitz's point is that many boxes have to be checked. But when many boxes are checked by a particular situation, there is threat. We do link it to some vital national interest in the sense that we worry about a country or bad actors getting a hold of weapons of mass destruction, those kinds of things.
And we're going to be nearby with that. I'm afraid we're out of time. But Tom Barnett, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Okay, thanks.
Tom Barnett is professor of warfare analysis at the Naval War College. And Owen Cote, thanks for being in with us tonight.
Thank you.
Owen Cote is associate director of the MIT Security Studies Program. Randall Kennedy, always great to have you. Thanks for being in.
Thank you very much.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. In a moment, JFK's view on America's role in the world, delivered 40 years ago today. This is On Point. Forty years ago today, President John F. Kennedy delivered one of his key foreign policy speeches during commencement exercises at American University in Washington, D.C. In the speech, Kennedy called on the Soviet Union to work with the United States on slowing down the arms race, and he spelled out his view of how world peace could be achieved. Kennedy's words have remarkable resonance four decades later. Here are some excerpts from President Kennedy's speech.
I have chosen this time and place to discuss a topic on which ignorance too often abounds and the truth too rarely perceived. And that is the most important topic on earth, peace. What kind of a peace do I mean, and what kind of a peace do we seek? Not a Pax Americana, enforced on the world by American weapons of war. Not the peace of the grave or the security of the slave. I am talking about genuine peace, the kind of peace that makes life on earth worth living, the kind that enables men and nations to grow and to hope and build a better life for their children. Not merely peace for Americans, but peace for all men and women. Not merely peace in our time, but peace in all time. I realize the pursuit of peace is not as dramatic as the pursuit of war, and frequently the words of the pursuers fall on deaf ears, but we have no more urgent task. Too many of us think it is impossible. Too many think it is unreal. But that is a dangerous, defeatist belief. It leads to the conclusion that war is inevitable, that mankind is doomed, that we are gripped by forces we cannot control. We need not accept that view. Our problems are man-made. Therefore, they can be solved by man. And man can be as big as he wants. No problem of human destiny is beyond human beings. Man's reason and spirit have often solved the seemingly unsolvable, and we believe they can do it again. I am not referring to the absolute, infinite concept of universal peace and goodwill, of which some fantasies and fanatics dream. I do not deny the value of hopes and dreams, but we merely invite discouragement and incredulity by making that our only and immediate goal. Let us focus instead on a more practical, more attainable peace, based not on a sudden revolution in human nature, but on a gradual evolution in human institutions, on a series of concrete actions and effective agreements which are in the interests of all concerned. There is no single simple key to this peace, no grand or magic formula to be adopted by one or two powers. Genuine peace must be the product of many nations, the sum of many acts. It must be dynamic, not static, changing to meet the challenge of each new generation. For peace is a process, a way of solving problems. With such a peace, there will still be quarrels and conflicting interests, as there are within families and nations. World peace, like community peace, does not require that each man love his neighbor. It requires only that they live together in mutual tolerance, submitting their disputes to a just and peaceful settlement. And history teaches us that enmities between nations, as between individuals, do not last forever. However fixed our likes and dislikes may seem, the tide of time and events will often bring surprising changes in the relations between nations and neighbors. So let us persevere. Peace need not be impractical, and war need not be inevitable. By defining our goal more clearly, by making it seem more manageable and less remote, we can help all people to see it, to draw hope from it, and to move irresistibly towards it.
President John F. Kennedy speaking at American University's commencement 40 years ago today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is WBUR. We're funded.